cab combs a snake, trying to rake in at last night's fare. And a solitary sailor who spends the facts of his life like small change on strangers. Pauses inside peacoat pocket.
Hello, welcome to a very special bonus edition of Love That Album podcast. I have for you a really terrific interview that I did a couple of weeks ago with Barney Hoskins, the biographer of Tom Waits. He's written a great book called Low Side of the Road, a biography of Tom Waits. And this interview was originally going to be part of Love That Album number 46 proper. However, my conversation with Pickerloaf of the Silver and Gold podcast was so enjoyable that we went on for quite a long time, and I sort of thought that maybe asking you listeners to download a 4-hour podcast was probably not a reasonable ask. So I've split it up into two shows. The reviews of Rain Dogs and The Heart of Saturday Night that I did with Pickerloaf is on one download, and this interview with Barney Hoskins is part of the download that you have just made. So I hope you enjoy. Without any further ado, here's my discussion with Barney Hoskins. Final editions on the stands.
The town crier's crying there with nickels in his hands. Pigs in a blanket, 69 cents. Eggs roll them over in a package of cans. Adam and Eve on a log, you can sink them damn straight. Hash browns, you know I can't be late.
Hello. I'm very, very excited. I always seem to say that, but I really, really am, because I have on the other end of a Skype connection, on the other side of the world to me, the author, Barney Hoskins, who his book, Low Side of the Road, A Life of Tom Waits, has been giving me a lot of pleasure over the last couple of weeks. Barney's background, he's been writing bios for quite a number of years, and he's also been writing for Mojo and Uncut magazine. Welcome to the show, Barney.
Pleased to be here.
Many thanks for your time. Just quickly, I mean, like running through a list of your bios, it seems that you have a bit of a passion for not only American subject matter, American musicians, but West Coast musicians at that. So you've gone and written books like, you know, Beneath the Diamond Sky about Hyde Ashbury, and Low Side of the Road, of course, and Waiting for the Sun and Hotel California. What is it that sort of drew you to West Coast American musicians? I mean, is that your particular passion? Or, I mean, I know you've written about Led Zeppelin and the Band, amongst others, but What made you choose the West Coast of America in particular?
Well, I mean, in general, I was obsessed with America and American music from a very young age. And I don't know exactly why that was. It's just something to do with, you know, just hearing American pop music on the radio and, you know, watching American movies and TV programs. I just kind of became obsessed with this place. And that led me ultimately to living in America for periods of my life, and I lived in Los Angeles for about a year in the early 1980s, and so my kind of obsession with Southern California commenced there and led to two books about the LA music scene, really. One, Waiting for the Sun, was a much bigger and broader kind of 50-year history of LA as a music city. And then Hotel California was a more kind of niche-y or sort of ring. Well, it was almost like taking a chapter of the earlier book and blowing it up into a book of its own. And so it was the story, really, of sort of Laurel Canyon as a place and as a kind of inspiration, Warner Reprise Records, the whole singer-songwriter thing, and all the country rock bands as well. So, you know, Waite sort of had a role to play in that book, particularly because he was on Asylum Records. So in a kind of misfit way, he was part of that stable of singer-songwriters. And obviously, you know, one of his most famous songs, Old 55, was covered by the Eagles, which made him his first decent money as a songwriter.
I was going to bring that up. I was going to bring that up actually a little bit later on, but we might as well talk about that now. You mentioned in the book, like on a number of occasions, that Waite had nothing but disdain for the Eagles and in general for what he called the Laurel Canyon Cowboys. Basically, you know, those people who he thought, well, you know, you don't go out to the country, you're just wearing a pair of jeans and a checked shirt and a cowboy hat and singing how great it would be to live in the country. And Waite himself, yes, I guess, copped a whole lot of flack for, you know, what you wrote about in the book, you know, from people saying, well, you're doing an act, you're doing a shtick, we're not completely convinced of it. But he said, look, I live in the city, this is my thing. Why do you think it was that he maybe copped so much flack for, you know, putting on initially that what you call, I think, in the book, the boho act? I mean, you know, someone like Dylan, for instance, he copped flack for not doing the act that he did, like in the beginning, not playing the folk singer. You know, when he went electric, he decided he wanted to do something else, and he copped flack for not doing the act. But Waite seemed to cop flack for doing, you know, what appealed to him.
Well, you know, Morris, I mean, I think anyone who gets on a stage in any kind of capacity is doing an act, some more disingenuously than others. But I mean, you know, as Waite has said himself, you know, you telling me that Dylan isn't doing an act, you telling me Neil Young isn't doing an act. Mm. Everybody's doing an act in some form or fashion. Waite chose to, in a rather more kind of artful and you know, conscious way, to sort of put on a kind of performance, to invent this character, the stumbling drunken boho character, you know, and it served him quite well. You know, it enabled him to create a sort of world and a milieu for his music, and it also enabled him to kind of hide behind this mask. I think now he kind of looks back on that character and sees it not in terms of honesty or dishonesty, but just in terms of limitation. I think he would now say that it was a rather limited sort of character. In other words, it was a character that he didn't really invent, but he kind of pieced together from his, you know, various influences from jazz and beat literature. And in that sense, right, he's really sort of disavowed it. I think he's almost disowned it, I think. And really since Swordfish Trombones in 1983, you know, I think he would say that he started creating a truly original sort of universe to write songs about. And I mean, nothing new under the sun, but the you know, Tom Waite we think of now is really absolutely, it's as close to being his own creation, his own thing, as, you know, as any body of music that anyone's made, I think, in 50, 60 years. You know, you can't kind of pin him down. You can't pigeonhole Tom Waits and in the way that you could pigeonhole the guy who made The Heart of Saturday Night.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let me ask you, what was it that, what was your first recollection of hearing Tom Waits? And, you know, what was it that drew you in? Was it the music? Was it that initial boho persona? And then what kept you with him?
Well, I mean, my first awareness of Waite was probably like Nighthawks at the Diner. I was just sort of being aware of that, being aware of him just coming to London, seeing pictures of him in this slouch cap, and not really sort of knowing enough about the references and the influences to sort of be able to play. I mean, I kind of realized he had something to do with jazz and beatniks, but I was too young to really, you know, kind of fit him into the greater scheme of things. It's a little bit later that I started, it was actually due to someone I think that he influenced very much, Nick Cave, who was a friend of mine. Nick, compatriot of yours. Nick was, I remember playing albums to me like Small Change and Blue Valentine, maybe, when I knew Nick. And so this is in the early 80s. Nick sort of indirectly or even maybe directly turned me on to Waits. And then Swordfish Trombones came out. And I remember we were all just, I was writing NME, New Musical Express at the time here in London. And I just remember how extraordinary Swordfish Trombones was. It just shook up any preconceptions or sort of set ideas you might have had about Tom Waits, particularly as it came out just after One from the Heart. And I remember just none of us being able to understand how one man could make two records so completely unlike as the One from the Heart soundtrack, which I love dearly, and then Swordfish Trombones. I still think that's an extraordinary year in the life of a creative artist. So we suddenly had a very contemporary artist who was not only leaving his own musical past behind, but he was completely at odds with what was happening in music in the early to mid 80s, you know, when everything was getting very sort of mechanical and synthetic. And here was this extraordinarily sort of organic, primitive sounding record, you know, with all sorts of different musical styles on it. And, you know, I still think it was a remarkable and audacious act of sort of self reinvention.
I sort of did a little bit of a survey just to sort of see what else came out in 1985, which is admittedly like a couple of years after Swordfish Trombones, but the year of Rain Dogs, just to sort of see, right, well, what were his contemporaries doing? And, you know, okay, so you've already gone and mentioned Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, where, you know, Firstborn is Dead came out, and, you know, Rum Sodomy and the Lash by the Pogues, and maybe Suzanne Vega's first album, you know, would have, you know, sort of, he would have fitted in maybe in that company. But what else was going on? There was, you know, the first album from Whitney Houston. There was Songs from the Big Chair by Tears for Fears, Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits, and all that like. So he certainly, you're mentioning that he didn't necessarily even fit in with Asylum era Tom Waits, but he certainly wasn't fitting in with any of his contemporaries either.
No, he was really, I mean, he did what every artist should do, which is to say, I am going to make the art that I want to make, and I'm going to follow my instinct, and I'm not going to try and second guess, you know, my public or my fans. I'm not going to try and please anybody other than myself, really. And I think that is sort of the sacred duty of art, because, you know, if you're not kind of following your own muse, then what, you know, what's the point? People are really only interested in what you can offer that's kind of uniquely yours, that's sort of singular. I mean, of course, having said that, the most sort of atypical or the track on Rain Dogs that sort of, paradoxically, is most shocking really now is Downtown Train, which is almost the only time that Waits has ever kind of compromised a little bit since Swordfish Trombones, shall we say. And, you know, kind of consciously written a sort of pop rock song that's going to work on the radio and has worked on the radio for other people. And I think the moment he'd done it, he regretted it.
Oh, really?
I mean, it's a great pop song, but I think it's sort of, he never sort of, as it were, made that mistake again. I don't have a problem with it, but it just sounds like a song that Springsteen could have written. And again, so what, you know, but it sort of sticks out in that sense. And I think And so I think, you know, he regretted it from that point of view. It kind of fits in with the rest of the record. But anyway, that's the basic point, I think, that Waits just really, you know, Waits is so influential in terms of how profoundly he rejected sort of the sound of 80s music, you know, the overproduction of everything, the sequencing of everything, you know, the over-elaboration, the 48 tracks, the, you know, the, just the everybody was using, you know, drum machines and electronic keyboards, and all these avatars of the 60s and 70s. And even Neil Young, you know, this guy who made the incredible sort of lo-fi records like, you know, like Tonight's the Night. You know, you know, come the 80s, even Neil makes an album called it's Lanny on Water and Life. I mean, there's drum machines on it. And electronic keyboards. And it just seems like that's where everyone was going. And Waits just refused to go there, as did Nick Cave, as did the Pogues. As you say, there were kindred spirits. I'm not sure that Waits was necessarily as aware of them as he probably is now. I mean, I think he was certainly a fan of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. I think he's certainly a fan of Shane McGowan and the Pogues. And, you know, there's a sort of fraternity of people like that who, you know, can't really admire each other for kind of sticking to their guns, you know. You know, I think the influence of Waits' records in the 80s has been so profound on subsequent sort of generations. I mean, I'm thinking of everyone from PJ Harvey to the late Mark Linkous of Sparkle Horse. You know, there's just so many artists who have Tom Waits to thank for sticking to his guns.
Mm. And all the more amazing considering that, you know, as you say in your book, when he was finishing his time off at Asylum and he'd done it with that character, he'd had it with that character. I think you even mentioned something about him discovering one of his Asylum records in a bargain basement bin. So he really sort of thought he'd, you know, he had nothing. He'd left no legacy. He was like, if he didn't do something then and there, he was off the map. He was just going to be completely forgotten about. And I guess I'd say it's certainly true that there's a lot of people who I've met who say that they're Tom Waits fans, but they only know of the Island and the Anti Records stuff. And I'm personally a huge fan of that Asylum Records era, and I suspect that, you know, you'd probably know a lot of people who would cite that era as something of an influence.
Indeed, you know, I mean, there are certainly people who prefer the earlier Waits. I mean, it is such a kind of before and after story, isn't it? Which is why my biography is like a life in two acts. It's such a sort of stark dividing line. I love both equally. You know, and it was interesting to me when I sort of compiled at the end of the book my 50 favorite Waits tracks.
Yes.
You know, literally split down the middle, half of them predated, you know, were from the sort of the Asylum years. And half of them were from the Island and post-Island years. And so I love both. I mean, I love both Waits. and obviously there are, it's not as if there's an absolute break between the two. I don't think there is. I think you can start to hear some of the places that Waits was going to go in, you know, the last two Asylum albums. And you know, there are people who only like the early Waits and people who only like the later Waits. But I think most real fans of Waits like both as much as I do, as much as probably you do.
Yes. Well, I just want to let's talk for a little bit about the two albums that's being discussed on this edition of the podcast. Now, I was sort of thinking about this. I sort of hadn't intended this when myself and my friend Alex had picked these two albums. But thinking about Heart of Saturday Night, in terms of the career, there's something of a symmetry. Both are second albums, you know, Heart of Saturday Night, For Real, and Rain Dogs for the second half of his musical career, or the rebirth. Both are way different to what their contemporaries were doing. Both, in my mind anyway, are high benchmark albums. Where do you see these albums in terms of at each point in his career? Are they important albums overall, or are they just great Tom Waits albums?
Well, you know, I mean, importance is a difficult thing to really sort of establish. You know, what is important and what is unimportant. I don't really, it doesn't really matter. You know, different things are important to different people and in a different context. I think that, you know, what you have to say about Heart of Saturday Night is that it certainly was about Waits doing in a kind of fully realized way what he really wanted, had probably wanted to do on the first album, but hadn't quite pulled off, or hadn't been allowed to quite pull off. You know, in other words, you know, let's go full tilt for the jazz beat boho thing. You know, Closing Time had hints and elements of that, but in many ways it wasn't so different from a lot of sort of piano man singer-songwriter albums. You know, it certainly didn't tell us where Waits was going to kind of end up,
right,
35 years later, right? I think Heart of Saturday Night, partly because, you know, David Geffen thought, look, let's, you know, this guy actually needs some serious, like, jazz musicians. He needs a producer who gets the references, who can talk to Tom about Jack Kerouac and Lord Buckley and so forth. So let's get Bones Howe in, you know, let's get a proper kind of sax player, and, you know, and let's get people in with chops, and let's facilitate Tom, let's make it possible for him to, you know, write in the mode that he really wants to write in, which includes the sort of jazz hipsteries, you know, recitation aspects of something like Diamonds on my Windshield, which wouldn't have worked, or it's unlikely that Tom wasn't ready to do that on the first album, I think, you know. So it's just a much more accurate representation of what Waits wanted to do with the character he'd invented, and this you know, this world he was exploring, this kind of nighttime neon world that he didn't really, it wasn't really present on Closing Time.
Mm. And Rain Dogs?
And Rain Dogs, you know, Rain Dogs is, you know, it's a strange one in many ways, because it's, you know, so much about New York City, or at least inspired by, anchored in New York City, which is not Waits's natural habitat or environment. You know, he had uprooted himself from his native Southern California to move to New York, I think, out of a slightly misguided sense that that's what you should do if you want to be a kind of, you really want to be a serious sort of artist. You know, you have to move to New York, and there's this whole kind of downtown scene going on there. And he wanted to do Gotham, you know, he wanted to do New York City. And, you know, maybe he and Catherine both felt that that was going to be important for his just artistic development. I think in the end, you know, he came to the conclusion actually that knew it wasn't a good fit for him. He didn't really want to be there. He needed more space around him, and he couldn't really at the end he couldn't really get California out of his system. He missed home, and so he went back there. But you know, I mean, Rain Dogs is, you know, it's in some sense a very urban album. It's all about Waits reacting to this very extreme environment where he felt like a fish out of water, I think, in many ways. It was quite an oppressive place, but also, you know, of course, very stimulating and exciting. I think when we listen back to the record, you know, obviously it follows on from Swordfish Trombones it kind of reiterates and deepens what he had achieved on Swordfish Trombones. You know, Swordfish Trombones was made up of all sorts of different things. It was a very eclectic piece of work. And Rain Dogs is equally eclectic. But what you've got is you have got a real sense of the Rain Dogs of the title, you know, are these marginalized street people, scuffling, suffering, you know, rejected by society. And, you know, nowhere is that more extreme, or certainly was more extreme than in New York City. You know, the extreme inequalities of kind of wealth and power as opposed to, you know, the people who don't make it there. And you know, Waits has always just been interested in, he's, you know, not interested in successful people. He's interested in, you know, not losers for the sake of being losers. He's just interested in real human beings who are struggling at the margins of the Western world, you think. And I think he found that, he found the place fascinating. He found it very inspiring. But the record also has lots of other stuff in it. You know, yes, there are songs about New York, but then there are, you know, at least half the songs are really not about New York. And, you know, Cemetery Polka is really not, has nothing to do with New York, has to do with his own sort of idea of his own relatives, his own family. Gun Street Girl, as I say in my book, I think is very much a template for the more rural, almost sort of, you know, Americana, country blues, mutant Americana of his later records. A real pointer there, you know, with the banjo and stuff. And then, you know, of course, we can't not talk about Keith Richards. You know, Keith with Tom in New York. There's a track called Union Square, you know, which is a place reference in New York City. Yep. But Big Black Mariah, you know, got this kind of sense of rock and roll in New York. And so it's really quite a diverse and eclectic piece of work, Rain Dogs. And I think it is. Yeah, you're right to draw the parallel. I think is interesting. You know, Heart of Saturday Night really cements what he didn't quite have the courage to do on his debut album, and Rain Dog sort of takes Swordfish Trombones into, you know, it just takes it a step forward. The musicianship is probably, I mean, you know, this is Mark Rebo is on the record, and you know what Fred Tackett managed to do on Swordfish Trombones, which should not be underrated. You know, Mark Rebo takes that maybe a kind of atonal dissonant step forward, and you know, Waits is really sort of you know, he's got the musicians around him that really serve this new music well.
Well, you mentioned Mark Ribot, and the thing that's always struck me about his work with Waits is, I guess, that that sort of staccato style of guitar playing, those really short, short little attacky type of notes, for lack of better expression. And you know, there were sort of like a whole lot of guitar heroes, people in if you could play like a million notes per minute, then, you know, guys with really long hair would worship at your altar. But for me, and obviously, you know, for Waits, who knew what he wanted, it was someone like Mark Ribot who was, you know, probably had all the chops that these other guys did, but really worked with more of a texture, that staccato thing, that rather than sort of going far more overblown like some of the more conventional guitar heroes were.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, this new music, you know, the island music, it's not anti-music, but it's certainly anti-rock and roll. It's anti-virtuosity. And it's very much about pulling in pre-rock and roll music forms into Waits' new musical language, I think. So, you know, polkas and rumbas and, you know, I mean, Waits is almost devising his very own kind of world music. I think that's what he wanted to do. He really just wanted to go beyond the limitations of rock and roll and sort of, you know, 4/4, you know, 4/4 rhythms and stock guitar riffs. And it's kind of like, why don't we kind of open this up to more diverse influences? Let's pull all this stuff in, but make it very much, you know, it's still very much my own voice and my own language, but I'm going to borrow a bit of, you know, tarantella here, a bit of rumba there, you know, I'm going to, you know, I'm all this stuff that Catherine's been turning me on to, you know, whether it's, you know, whether it's sort of Cuban music or it's gospel music, or indeed if it's blues, you know, I mean, Walking Spanish is a sort of a throwback to the style of Blue Valentine or Heart Attack and Vine. So it's not as if, you know, there's no connection to Waits' past. He's happy to do things like that when it works, you know. I mean, the great quote that he said at the time of Swordfish Trombones is that, you know, he wanted musical settings and textures and rhythms that fit the characters he was singing about, rather than, you know, just kind of stock instrumentation and arrangement. You know, he wanted songs that sound, music that sounded like the characters he was writing about, you know, and I think that's, you know, that's what he achieved on Swordfish Trombones, and it's what he achieved on Rain Dogs. It's what he's achieved, or certainly aspired to doing ever since then.
So, was there anything in your research that ever sort of suggested that maybe he was sort of like reacting with his music by making non-musical observations? He was looking the world around him, the world beyond the jazz joints of Los Angeles, or beyond the film noir that you mentioned he was so fond of watching. Were these different musical styles in reaction to just other things, like, you know, seeing what was happening in the news or reading history books, and he thought, well, I could come up with a tune that reflects what I'm reading there. Anything in your research turn up something like that?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think it's very clear that he just had a kind of an epiphany, and it had a lot to do with Catherine's influence, and he just suddenly saw that the boho jazz character, the part that he played was, you know, was, it just wasn't original. It was a very narrow, circumscribed creature, and there was just, you know, the world out there was infinitely richer. So it was really about kind of expanding way beyond that. As entertaining as it had been, it was suddenly like, well, there's just so much more going on in the world and going on in music. Why limit yourself? You know, why pretend to be, you know, some sort of barfly character in a film noir classic from the 40s, you know? Let's sing about Hong Kong and Singapore. Let's also sing about, you know, Texas. So let's do you know, a kind of crazed jazz instrumental about Midtown Manhattan. Let's cast around. Let's open this up, you know. And I think that's really the point, isn't it? You know, I mean, he can't change his voice, and so forth. And there's certain things that are just going to be what Tom Waits does. You know, it's not like you're ever going to listen to anything he's done since Swordfish and not think, well, that's Tom Waits. You know, you always know that it's Tom Waits, but it's Tom Waits, you know, to put it in very sort of simplistic metaphorical terms, it's Tom Waits wearing, you know, lots of different outfits and lots of different kinds of hats, you know, rather than just the same hat and the same stained suit.
So I would argue, you know, based on what we were speaking a little bit before about Downtown Train, and you were suggesting, well, it's this little pop thing that maybe didn't necessarily fit on Rain Dogs, but by virtue of that album's diversity, maybe it actually did.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine. It works there. It's just it's clearly the most mainstream thing that you hear on the record. I mean, interestingly, Stephen Hodges, the drummer on the record, and also he drummed on the previous one, on Swordfish, you know, said that he told me that there was an earlier version of Downtown Train with the core band on Rain Dogs, and, you know, including him and Reburn, and Waits, in what would seem to have been a quite calculated way, decided to re-record the song with a different band that included G.E. Smith, who became Dylan's guitar player, and Tony Levine. Mm. It was almost like he'd sort of, okay, let's do a version of this that, I don't know whether it was Chris Blackwell that talked him into it at Island, or something at Island said, come on, let's try and get a hit. It can't hurt. It's not going to distort what the record is or who you are, you know. And I guess Waite thought, okay, you know what? I'll throw them this bone. We'll do a kind of, you know, it's not gonna be a Bob Seger record or a Rod Stewart record, to cite two of the people who covered the track, but I'll do it with just enough of a kind of commercial sheen, and maybe we'll get a hit out of it, and then maybe lots of people, will listen to the record and fall in love with Cemetery Polka or Tango Till They Saw. You know, I can only imagine that's what he thought, and then maybe after he thought, no, actually, I'm not going to do that again. And, you know, for sure, there's nothing like Downtown Train on Frank's Wild Years.
Mm. I want to come back to the discussion that we're having about image and the like. Okay, it's never been the case for anyone else that I associated with one instrument. But I remember, you know, when I first sort of heard these Island records, and, you know, this is like after having really enjoyed, you know, the piano stylings that he'd gone and done, that, you know, here he was doing something completely different. It really freaked me out. You could listen to, what was the album, a couple of albums back, Real Gone, I think there was no keyboard on it whatsoever. And, like, you know, when he sort of decided he was going to do more with the guitar, this sort of seemed to me like this is part of his declaration of a separation from his past. I mean, do you think that, you know, his greater reliance on the guitar was about shedding of that previous image, or was it just, once again, part of wanting to see sonically what else he could do?
Yeah, I think there was a shedding there. I think part of the rationale was, you know, if I sit down at the keyboard, you know, my fingers just automatically fall into certain shapes, and it's almost like automatic pilot. It's very hard to just think outside what I've always done when I sit at the piano, you know. So in order to challenge myself and sort of step into the unknown, I have to step away from the piano and just almost like come up with, you know, vocal lines, out of nothing, or you know, just start somewhere different. I know if I start at the piano, I know pretty much, you know, where I'm going to go. And you know, he does. I mean, it's Johnsburg, Illinois, on Swordfish, and yeah, I think it's interesting that there isn't a Johnsburg, Illinois on Rain Dogs, you know, or not for a long, you know, there isn't anything like that for a while. He does eventually, he goes back to the piano a bit later in his work. It's like he kind of makes friends with it again. But on Rain Dogs, I mean, he very much, it's like, I'm not going to do anything remotely sort of sentimental or tender, I think. I mean, there's tenderness on the record, but not in that way.
I thought that on Mule Variations, Pictures in a Frame was probably the most tenderly romantic and you know, closest return to his early style that he'd gone and done in many a year. And it was all the more interesting considering that this was yet a new start, you know, his first post-Island Years record.
Yeah, I mean, I love Mule Variations. It's one of my very favorite Waits records. My absolute favorite, and really almost possibly my favorite Waits piano, you know, ballad, tender ballad is Take It With Me. It's just such an incredible song. But Picture in a Frame is great too. I mean, there's three or four on that record that are, you know, really, really fantastic. But it's a very different kind of piano, isn't it? It's this sort of very it's like the sound of an upright piano in a sort of front parlor room.
It does, yes.
You know, recorded in a very ambient way. So it's very different from even from Johnsburg, Illinois, let alone from the early piano stuff on the Asylum records.
Right. Now I think it would probably be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit. You've already gone and mentioned Kathleen Brennan, but your book sort of, you know, brings up the fact, as you know, it came about with some of the interviews that you made with people like Bones Howe, saying that Kathleen Brennan actually saved him. I mean, they've been fairly private as a married couple, but you know, certainly health wise, as well as sort of, you know, possibly helping him to work out how he went with his career from the Island Years onwards. But do you think he could not have made an album like Swordfish, Trombones, or Rain Dogs, or indeed anything that came after that, without her behind him, you know, either through introduction of some of the musical styles which he proclaimed to have not heard, i.e. Captain Beefheart, or just by, you know, being there to say, I believe in you, I think you can do this, you can ditch the boho if you want to. Could he have made those albums without her?
Well, we'll never know, Morris, will we? We'll never know what he could or would or might have done without Kathleen. I tend to think that he may be attributes a little too much influence to her. You know, I mean, the whole the Captain Beefheart thing is a case in point. You know, he was managed by, had been managed by the same guy who managed Captain Beefheart. You know, he'd been out on the road with Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. It's hard to believe that he hadn't listened to Captain Beefheart. You know, right. I mean, you listen to Heart Attack and Vine, and you know, how could he not have listened to Captain Beefheart?
Right.
The idea that Kathleen turned him on to Beefheart, I mean, she, you know, I mean, people I interviewed who'd known Kathleen will say she really wasn't, she didn't have a big record collection. You know, she was not a musician, she was a literature person, she was a literature major. You know, that was her focus, was on the writing, was on words and writing. So I just think they came together, and it wasn't so much about whether Kathleen sat Tom down and, you know, told him to listen to Beefheart or whatever, or Lithuanian, you know, dance music. I think it was more just about, you know, something there was something just catalytic there for Waits. She opened his eyes. She kind of shook him up. She took him into places that he hadn't been before. And, you know, I think that was what tipped him into a place where he thought, oh, hang on a minute, there's more to life than, and I'm just going down a dead end really with the shtick that I've been doing, the character that I've been playing. You know, I mean, it's a dead end. And they don't even care about me at Elektra Asylum anymore. You know, any novelty value I had is sort of like, has gone. You know, all they care about is, you know, is Queen and the Eagles, and
right,
you know, they're big prestige, they're big artists, you know, and it just doesn't, I just don't count anymore. So everything sort of changed overnight. I think Kathleen's influence was more about, you know, it was a sort of a more general sort of influence. But I think she also, we have really his words to go by. He claims that she saved his life and enabled him, at least for a while, not to drink so self-destructively, and ultimately to stop drinking completely. I think, you know, they were just a great kind of romantic, creative and matrimonial partnership. And I think the revelation to him was that he could be with a woman who he loved and who loved him. It didn't have to be self-destructive. It didn't have to be melodramatic. It could start a family. He could have all that and be creatively energized too. And that's served him extremely well.
Mm. All right. Well, I think we've really sort of gone and preempted in the discussion what was going to be my final question, which was for you, you know, Elektra Asylum versus Ireland, which is it even a relevant question? And, you know, you've already sort of gone and said you love both equally. So I'll take this final Waits related conversation in a slightly different direction. It's sort of influenced by a discussion I had with a work colleague yesterday. I think, like, I was sitting around at lunchtime eating my sandwich and reading your book, and this fellow came up to me, and he, you know, fairly young, just fresh out of university, and he said, oh, you know, what's your reading? And I showed him the book, and he said, oh, I don't know who Tom Waits is, you know, what does he do? And because I don't necessarily see that this fellow is that musically involved, but his question was sincere. And I thought, how do I describe what Tom Waits is? If I were to introduce him to three songs that says, this is what Tom Waits is, if I were to say to you, how would I show this fellow? What would be, like, not necessarily your three favorite Tom Waits songs, but what would be the three songs you'd introduce to someone who didn't know who Tom Waits was to say, right, well, this is far from comprehensive, but this gives you an idea who Tom Waits was and is.
I mean, I would probably want to choose, you know, some extreme polarities, aren't there? There's probably, you know, a very tender piano ballad at one end of the spectrum, and then a really brutal thing at the other. So I'd probably kind of go for, I mean, I'm looking at my list of favorite tracks. And so you could sort of say, well, you know, you might have Kentucky Avenue at one end and then, you know, Heart Attack and Vine at the other, or Take It With Me at one end of the spectrum and then Going Out West at the other, you know. So it might be two out of those three. And then you'd have to choose, like, Tom Traubert's Blues, I think, because it is his greatest song. I think it's his greatest song. It's certainly his most moving song. I think it's where all his where all the sort of sleaze and despair and compassion come together. So it would have to be that, and then it would be something really loud and raucous and beef hearty and like Going Out West or Heart Attack and Mine, and then something really tender and sweet like Take It With Me, Broken Bicycles, Picture in a Frame, Johnsburg, Illinois. You know, there aren't many artists, Morris, who can do such different things. I mean, you think of someone like Neil Young, you know, who can do really sort of cauterizing, grungy, punky rock and roll with Crazy Horse, you know, with really sort of vicious, sort of squalling guitar sounds. And then he can, you know, he can go off stage and come back and play, you know, You and Me or The Needle and the Damage Done on his own on acoustic. And it's just so sort of quiet and soft and tender. I think Waits is the same. You know, he says it's the alcoholic's remorse following the kind of blowout on Saturday night. You know, you sort of stumble out of bed and sit at the piano and express your remorse and contrition for whatever the hell you did in a blackout the night before. So that's his kind of how he explains the polarities, but that doesn't cover what he does now because he's been sober many years and you know, he can still do, you know, Bad as Me, I thought was a terrific record. I hate the cliched phrase return to form, but I thought it was a really musical record after what had been a rather amusical album in Real Gone. It was really arranged. The horns were amazing on it. But he can still do the sort of brutal stuff and then just take your breath away with something that's very soft and empathic, you know. If I was, going to try and sit someone down and say, well, this is, hey, the many moods of Tom Waits.
So I should probably be making him a mixtape or something like that, not two or three songs.
Exactly. Yeah, you probably need like four or five things probably just to sort of illustrate the basis that this man can cover.
Right. Look, I want to thank you so very, very much for sitting and taking the time, especially with your throat and the lozenges and all that.
My throat ailment. Well, it's sort of appropriate, really, for Waits. We know the places his voice has gone over the years.
We do.
Apt.
All right. Look, thanks so much for your insight, Barney. I'm once again so grateful that you were able to afford me the time for the Love That Album podcast. And I'm sure all the listeners out there will have certainly gained some more insight into the music that was that and still is. It's a living beast of Tom Waits and your insight into Ray Manzarek at the end. Really appreciated. If the listenership out there wants to delve into further of your books besides Low Side of the Road, A Life of Tom Waits, what are some of the other writings? I know you've got your website, rocksbackpages.com.
Rocksbackpages, yeah, absolutely. A lot of stuff on there, some of my stuff, but many, many thousands of pieces by many other writers, most of the best music writers of the last kind of 60 years, actually, really. So there's a lot of stuff on there and audio interviews with everyone from Waits to Hendrix and Kurt Cobain. But I mean, if the books I'm proudest of probably are Hotel California and Across the Great Divide, my book about the band, and I guess Waiting for the Sun, the LA book. There's a few other things in there that aren't quite as substantial as that, but I still think are kind of okay. A little book about glam rock, a little book about Prince. So there's some other stuff in there.
I recommend the listeners out there do a bit of a search be it on Amazon or Google or however it is that you choose to be able to track down copies of the books, and go out and buy them. They'll be a great read. And as I said, I'm really, really loving Low Side of the Road. Once again, Barney Hoskins, thank you so much for your time today on Love That Album.
Thank you so much, Morris. Real pleasure to speak with you.
Cheers.
This is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.